Committee would come to order, please. This is the Senate State Affairs Meeting. It is Thursday, April 28th, 3:40 in the afternoon. Members who are present at this time, Senators Elkin, Huggins, Vice Chair Wagner, and myself, Senator Terrio. I'd like to first turn our attention to Senate Bill 121 and 122. The co-chairs of Finance have asked me as chairman to ask the committee to consider moving the vehicles up to Finance. Not an indication that of support from individual committee members, but the co-chairs feel that they may need the bills as vehicles one way or another as the session comes to a close.
I'm doing that, Mr. Chairman.
With that, I'd like to bring 121 before us at this time and see if members have questions from the hearing that we had previously. And let the record show that Senator Davis has joined us. If there are no questions, can we have a motion? Senator Wagner.
Move Senate Bill number 121 / A with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Without objection, the bill will move to its next committee referral. Brings up 122. And let's see. Cheryl, it's my understanding that the House version of this passed the House and is being reconsidered. Were there modifications that were made in that bill that we should consider at this time?
Cheryl Braska, Office of Management and Budget. The House passed the legislation that sets up the account, which would be Senate Bill 121, I believe. Of course, I only have my House bills here. So they amended the bill that sets up the account. They did not take action on the let me withdraw everything I just said. The answer is yes, they did. They did amend Senate Bill 122.
Want to bring us up to speed on what amendments they made?
Mr. Barnhill is here from the Department of Law, so he can give you the definitive answers.
Mr. Chair, Mike Barnhill, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. What the House did in the House Finance Committee was change, first of all, in the House bill and the Senate bill before you, it created a fund within the earnings reserve of the Alaska Permanent Fund. What the House did was they took that out of the earnings reserve of the Permanent Fund and put it in the General Fund. And they changed the name from Capital Income Account to Capital Income Fund. So the money that flows, the earnings that flow from the segregated Amerada Hess principal would then go into this fund within the general fund and be available for appropriation for whatever purpose. The idea of using those earnings to finance an issuance of bonds, which was the governor's original proposal, was not adopted by the House. They let that vehicle go, and they only passed just making the earnings go into this new fund within the general fund. The other thing they did was with respect to inflation proofing, and this was a topic of extensive discussion within the House finance hearing. And what they did there was ensured that the money that has been segregated within the principal of the Alaska Permanent Fund would continue to be inflation-proofed. But I think at our last meeting, Senator Terrio, you wondered why they were accounting for that within the picket fence. It will, under the House version, all that inflation-proofing will happen outside of the picket fence. So that nominal amount will stay the same, but yet the entire principal of the Permanent Fund will continue to be inflation-proofed.
Senator Elton, question?
Well, you saw the puzzled look, Mr. Chair. So Amerada Hess subaccount will not be inflation-proofed, but the inflation-proofing that would have covered the Amerada Hess will be in the rest of in the rest of the corpus of the permanent fund.
That's right.
So the rest of the corpus will be, if we assume that it is now being inflation-proof, will be slightly over-inflation-proof.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a little bit of a stretch to say we're inflation-proofing any one part of the principal of the permanent fund. When we inflation-proof the entire principal of the permanent fund. The Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation has been accounting for that inflation-proofing separately, but that's a book accounting mechanism. In this bill that the House just passed today, they are clarifying that they want that accounted for outside of the segregated principle of the Amerada Hess.
So over time, the value of the Amerada Hess subaccount will diminish due to the erosion of inflation.
Purchasing power would erode.
Yeah.
However, the inflation is just being, when forced to add it up and say whether it accrues on the inside of the fence or outside of the fence, the inflation proofing is on the outside of the fence.
That's right.
Senator Wagner?
Well, yeah, but that doesn't keep us at a future date from putting money back into inflation proof the principal of the fund that still is in the permanent fund. We have the ability to do that at any time, don't we?
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, I think that if you wanted to direct the Permanent Fund Corporation to book that inflation proofing within the Alaska and within the Amerada Hess picket fence, you could do that. It's the principal value of the permanent fund is going to stay the same where you account.
It just depend on how much of that earnings that we encumbered on the Amerada Hess side of it is what.
The earnings from the Amerada Hess segregated fund are going to continue to flow out under the House bill, are going to flow into the general fund.
Total earnings.
The total earnings on that, what is it, $424 million, that figure is going to stay the same throughout time.
I don't agree with that. That's all right.
Okay, so we know there's a variety of ideas on the subject out there, and the question before the body is if we want to incorporate those ideas as a CS or whether we want to just move this with its companion piece. The House bill will then come and be referred to finance. So, Senator Elton.
Well, Mr. Chair, my preference, I guess, would be to move it as it is. And my second preference would be that you pass along to the co-chairs of Senate Finance that Senator Davis and I are more than willing to do whatever they want to do. We accede to their request to move it out here.
Would you like to make the motion?
Sure, Mr. Chair. I move SB 122 with the attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Without objection, the bill will be sent along with 121 up to finance. Okay, let's see. Next, I would like to take up House Bill 181.
I can attach a letter of intent saying that the minority members are.
Go ahead, Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. House Bill 181 has one major objective, and that is for licensing continuing education credits for those who serve in the military full-time and reserve and auxiliary forces. If they're out, when it comes time for the renewing of their license, this would hold them so that they could go ahead and practice, and then they would do their renewal when they get back. So it's a partial exemption for those in military who other people would have to be required to do the continuing education renewal of their licensing. This would give an exemption to those doing military service, not able to go through the process here in Alaska, but they would be required to go through that process when they return to Alaska. So it's just in section F on page 2 is the guts of it, and it's permissive. It gives the licensing division a little bit of flexibility.
So, so Representative Coghill, let's walk through an example. So, an individual that has an AUK license gets sent overseas for a 12-month tour of duty. When he and he's got some continuing education requirements that he would have undertaken during that 12 months. When he comes back, does he have to? Does he have to get that to continue education taken care of right away, or it's extended out for the same amount of time that he was overseas? How do you want that to work?
I may have to ask one of my staff members to come up for that particular example. But I think what we did was we allowed some flexibility in the AUK licensing because so many of them have different, some are two-year renewals, some are one-year renewals, and I'm, I would be, I would have to be instructed on that myself. The idea was that when they did come back, they weren't forbidden to practice. Do I have an eager staff ready to come on up? The person who's actually been carrying this, and I told her, I said, protocol-wise, I think I'm supposed to introduce it, but she's really the expert. So my staff, Karen, really may know very well know the answer.
For the record, my name is Karen Lidster, and I'm on the staff with Representative Coghill. And if you notice, there were two changes. Both the boards and commissions have the ability to, they may waive it, and it was felt that they know, obviously, the needs and requirements and would be able to set the time frames according to what they felt was best for the particular profession and the requirement of how many credits were necessary. So it actually leaves it quite open to the boards and commissions since they are the people that know the profession and what is required. And so they can put in the request and it be dealt with on an individual basis.
Senator Huggins?
Number one, thank you, Representative Coghill, for doing this, and Karen. As I see it, it creates a mechanism where the board can do it, doesn't require it. Is that accurate? And the other one, based on the discretion within that realm and the licensing, I don't know, let's take a school teacher. All right, they have to have continuing education. Based on the circumstances, the board then, on individual cases, can determine then what length of period the person will be given to renew their license.
Exactly. Through the chair, Senator Huggins, that is exactly correct, and that's why we use the word may.
It's a great idea, and I mean, I have enough faith in the boards to realize that, number one, they're professional. They understand the needs of whatever that profession turns out to be, number one. Number two is that they also understand the criticality of making sure the person is current, so they, you know, they won't have too long a period of time. And the other part of it, quite frankly, is that those people that are called to active duty, it may or may not be with short notice. And that's one of those things that, you know, I think we have to have some flexibility on our part because they're out doing our business. So.
One of the thoughts that I had in I thought, why flexibility, number one, for that very reason. But there are some places where they may be stationed on active duty where they could actually, in fact, get those qualifications certified properly. And so we didn't want to, we first started off saying in an active war zone, and we kicked it around quite a bit. We're really finding, because even in some places overseas, you can still get the certification necessary. There are some places you just can't.
And I know that in Alaska right now, we have a number of National Guardsmen that were activated that are at Fort Greeley. And they may or may not be able to keep their currency, but they're displaced. And there's a lot of difficulties with being displaced and trying to do normal life kind of activities.
My thinking was if a person, for example, up in Fort Wainwright, we have a huge deployment coming up. By the time you have moved your family, moved with your unit, done your duty and moving in and out of wherever your deployment area is, and you're a dentist and you're required to have an annual update, a person could go to the dental board and said, say, I was not able to. But if they're deployed to a place where they could have, the dental board may have said, you missed your opportunity. So, you know, I think we're trying to not give them a total out.
Other questions? Do we have anybody else here or on teleconference that wishes to testify on House Bill 181? Seeing none, what's the will of the committee? Senator Wagner.
I move CS for House Bill number 181. Backslash S with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Without objection, the bill will move from committee to its next committee referral.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, take up House Bill 201.
For the record, my name is Eric DeLand, staff for Representative Mike Chenault, and the purpose of this bill is to permit the person who has power of attorney for an individual serving on active military duty with the United States Armed Services outside the state of Alaska to sign and file a permanent fund application for said individual. It's that easy. We've ended up with situations where someone has been called into the Guard. I know we have a Fort Wainwright deployment coming up, and these gentlemen could not get their PFD app signed in time. Yes, PFD did assist in getting them later on out to Iraq, but in the meantime, we had families wondering, wondering how they could legally sign for their husband or wife's PFD. Power of attorney would take care of that.
Do you know the... I know they have centers now when they're getting ready to do a deployment. They run all the personnel through to make sure that they've taken care of certain paperwork. And I don't know if this power of attorney is just a standard thing that they're encouraged to sign, and whether when the language here says in specific or general terms. So the power of attorney is that they're generally given before being deployed, or is it specific or general?
The power of attorney is usually a general power of attorney for a husband or wife or whomever to make decisions for that person while they are serving their duty.
Do you have any idea what kind of terminology it uses? Is it just the above referenced person has power to sign all legal documents?
Generally, that is correct.
Have you, by chance, taken one of those and run it by the dividend division to see whether their interpretation of the statute that form would meet that requirement?
We actually had the division up in our office and asked them, why wouldn't this apply? They came back with, well, you'll have to change it legislatively. That's what we're doing here, sir.
Senator Wagner?
I guess I have a hard time understanding if a person's got a power of attorney for another individual, why we would have to do anything statute-wise. Power of attorney is a pretty broad and document.
I've got just the person to answer your question.
Good.
Mrs. Barton.
I would be very hesitant giving anybody a power of attorney.
Mr. Chairman, Sharon Barton, Director of the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. Our statutes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Wagner, specifically require a person to individually sign their application. So powers of attorney with only a couple of exceptions are not allowed under our specific statutes.
That's interesting.
I'm married to an attorney. We don't leave on a vacation without signing a power of attorney for our house sitter to take the cat to the vet. You know, I do it all the time.
Wow.
Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, just information flow-wise, you know, once upon a time when I was a Veterans Affairs guy for the state, if you delete people that were calling about some difficulty their son or daughter was having in the Army outside of permanent fund,
number one issue, particularly with parents, because, you know, the assumption, and now you have the online mechanism, and we thought that would solve it. Unfortunately, there's a sizable number of people that it hasn't solved for, because we always think if you have a consult, you can operate in, a lot of those young people are, do not have the access to what we would think is normal activity in their life. I think this is just a smart thing to do. I know for some of my constituents, some of my friends and other people I just talked to on the telephone, this would be a great blessing. And I don't have any concerns about abuses of it. Do you have any concerns about abuses?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Huggins, we had early concerns about the problem we might have because through a power of attorney, you can't represent another's intent. And our statutes require a person to have the intent to return and remain in the state of Alaska. The House CS seeks to help at least with that, with D3 requiring a separate statement signed by the member that they intend to return.
I'm sorry, D3?
On the first page. You have a CS?
On the first page.
I defer this to you, Mr. Wright.
Sure.
Senator, I apologize for the record. I'm Sue Wright. The concerns as far as intent, a general power of attorney is an intent to give the authority and power to allow under number K any benefits to negotiate, sign for, and complete benefits from government programs and military service. And this is something that we've discussed in previous committees, and it was discussed on the House floor. This should no longer be a concern of the Permanent Fund Division. It's not, intent is included within a general power of attorney, and I can show you a copy of that if you'd like.
Any further questions? Sharon?
Mr. Chairman, I would love to tell you a little bit about what we are doing, did do during this last application period as far as the military is concerned. We don't have a problem implementing the provisions of this bill, but now we do have hindsight into last filing period, and we went into the filing period hearing from many of the concerned family members. How were they going to get their fairly recently deployed family members' signatures on a piece of paper when they didn't even know if they were going to be able to get mailed to them? So we had a lot of anxious phone calls early in the session, as did some of you, I think. We worked with DMVA, and in fact, they saw that applications got hand carried to those deployed from the state of Alaska to our members over in Iraq, and hand carried back and delivered to the division for processing. We received many of them that way. Interestingly enough, we received others by email, web application, and others yet that they simply filled out themselves by hand and mailed back over to us. We tracked each and every one of those persons to be sure we got an application from them. If there are follow-up questions from any of them, we'll delay, pen those applications as long as necessary to get what we need to pay them. Also, all of them who are deployed have under last year's legislation, the opportunity to file late. They can file their application as soon as they return to the state, or return to a place where they can file, where they're out from under the hostile fire and imminent danger situation. So we worked very hard to meet their needs, and from every indication, now at the end of the filing period, we were able to do that. So that's just background, but technically on the bill, I understand from Chris Pogue, our Assistant Attorney General, who's sitting back here and would be happy to talk with you himself. You need a small technical amendment if you want to go ahead with the bill. As it stands, as a separate provision in statute, would still be in conflict with the requirement to sign in 4323015C, which could be remedied with a small technical amendment.
And what would that language be?
Perhaps Chris, who's done some thinking about that, could tell you more quickly than and accurately than I.
Good afternoon, Chris Pogue, Department of Law. I'm in 4323015, subsection C. I'll read the language as it is and tell you where I think there should be just one small addition. It is the exception provision for the personal signature requirement. It says, except as provided in D or as provided in regulation, an individual must personally sign. The conformity, the technical amendment to make this conforming with this change would probably have to read, except as provided in D of this section, comma, AS 4323011D, comma, or as provided by regulation. So you would just simply have to add a reference to the provision that we're adding in Section 1. So it could be done real quickly in Section 2, and it's a small amendment, and it would fix the whole problem. But otherwise, there is a conflict.
Sue, do you have a statement on that?
Senator, Mr. Chair, I might be confused. In Section 1, could you review for me what proposed amendment we're talking about?
I think what they just, since we're making another exception in sub D, they just want to add that to the list of exceptions up in sub C. Is that correct?
I think I need to back up. I see she's reading from House Bill 201, introduced 3405, and I'm looking at CS for House Bill 201. I think that's where, I guess we're talking about two different versions. I'm not sure which version is before the body today.
I don't see a CS for 201.
201.
That's where I was confused too.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, the version that passed the House, I believe, was the original version that was introduced, which is House Bill 201. The CS was not passed. The CS did not include the hostile, imminent pay, imminent danger pay, because Representative Chenault felt that anyone in a military uniform is in imminent danger.
So, back up and...
Mr. Chairman, I think probably the seat needs to be given back to Director Barton, because I think she did express concerns with not limiting this. I think she feared that this would open the door broader than necessary to address the problem, and I suspect she probably would like to be heard on that.
Mr. Chairman, Sharon Barton again. We have no indication that other military members are having any problem whatsoever in filing their permanent fund dividend applications. Again, if it's the will of the legislature, we'll implement a full power of attorney. Simply need you to know that we see no need whatsoever for it beyond possibly beyond those who are serving under the dire conditions of hostile fire or imminent danger.
Okay, so Sue, your boss did not, military person that's stationed down in Texas, you want to have the power of attorney apply for that person.
Mr. Chair, respectfully and very respectfully, Representative Chenault feels that the deployment, the speed at which a company or a person with specific talents could be deployed and not have the time to prepare or to sign a permanent fund dividend application. Anytime anyone is in a military uniform supporting any one of us in the military service, they are in imminent danger. And this is not something he feels very strongly that we not impede the military in applying for their PFDs. Our office personally has one particular case where a gentleman was deployed from Nikiski, and he had to be brought back because his son had a terminal disease, and during that time his wife had to deal with the back and forth indecision of the permanent fund dividend division, and I'm not assuming that they knew that this young man was terminally ill at the time, but the additional stress on the family was great enough that when they had to bring his father back from Iraq, it was devastating to the family that they had any additional pressure from any state agency at all. Representative Chenault and I have had numerous discussions about this, and he feels very strongly that anytime anyone is in a military uniform defending our country in any size, shape, or fashion, be it at the White House in Texas, in Cleveland, Ohio, they're targets for anyone out there. And imminent pay and hostile danger pay should not be one of the criteria used. These general powers of attorney that are signed under the direction of the Alaska Post with very specific directions about how to use them and what they're prepared for are very helpful when people are planning to be deployed. We've had kids that have gone to Afghanistan, and we've actually not been able deployed out of Okinawa, and it's taken us months before they even realize they have a permanent fund problem. Their mother back in Nikiski knows, but they don't know. And there has been a real problem, and it takes a significant amount of our time in our office. And these kids that are serving our country should not have this problem when they've prepared for it by signing a general power of attorney.
Senator Huggins, having some experience, I'm sure, with deployment.
I would echo what Sue just said in the respect, I mean, I already talked about the statistics. I know you described a scenario where a National Guard unit went, and the National Guard guys can get all that stuff and communicate. For, you know, Sue's son, my daughter, whatever the case may be, if they're in a unit someplace else, we cannot do that. We never do that. They're on their own. And, you know, as a person that, you know, a veteran, for lack of a better term, the last thing I want is for any of our young people that have left Alaska to go serve our country to be worried about their permanent fund dividend. We should be doing everything we can. And to me, this is just a common sense vehicle that allows that to happen. It, quite frankly, in my estimation, lowers the burden on you because you don't have to. It's another mechanism to make it work. I don't see scenarios where abuse would be a problem per se with this, but I don't deal with permanent funds on a continuing basis. But I can tell you that more than you count on your, at least your hands, of people, of mostly mothers, to be quite frank, of young people that left Alaska and were someplace around the world. I don't remember the specifics, but they said, my goodness, my mostly sons, but my child did not get, and I can't help because of the rules. You can't, and they said, you know, if we could only do this, and some, you talked to them about doing it online, they said, you know, that's a good step forward, but, and then they get on with their language with but. So in my estimation, this is a low risk. I don't see any risk at all, and it's kind of the right thing to do for our people that are are out serving the country.
Senator Huggins, I guess the two things that we're always seem to be dealing with in the building here is, you know, letting people into the system that we think are deserving, and also trying to squeeze out fraud. And I'm just wondering how we balance the two. If a person is active duty but stationed in Washington State with access to the internet, with access to the U.S. mail, with access to the U.S. phone system, are there scenarios where they really, really, without too much effort, are not going to be able to make that application for themselves? But clearly, when they're overseas, even if they're in one of the Western European countries, the different mail system, phone system, I can see that.
I guess I understand that. You know, my concern is simple. If the smaller we make the mesh in the net on permanent funds, or there's always going to be some people that unintended-wise get caught up in it. The person that is at Fort Bliss, Texas, unpredictable in a number of scenarios where they go someplace, come all those things which equal, they're not quite as stable as you might imagine, or they might be completely stable. But every time you try to get at a scenario that is at Fort Bliss, Texas, there are some circumstances that that person gets caught in that you can't project. I've gone on record, and I firmly believe and do not want to open a window to fraud. In this respect, I don't have that concern. I mean, if power of attorney. But I think most people are prudent about who they give power of attorney to. So I just think people are safeguarded in that respect.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'm confused. I mean, the way I read the bill backslash A that is in front of us, this doesn't cover a person who's stationed at Fort Bliss. It only covers a person who has signed a power of attorney and is as a member of the armed forces who is serving on active duty outside the United States.
Mr. Chairman.
It would seem to me that the difference between the committee substitute is they'd have to be serving outside the United States and eligible for combat pay. I don't have a problem with the backslash version A because it doesn't open up the net. Widely, it applies only to members of the armed forces outside the United States.
Hey, but you're right, Senator, and thank you. That addresses a lot of my concern. But you added on, though, that outside the United States and combat pay. I don't think that's a requirement necessarily. Just active duty.
That was combat pay or whatever the technical. It was combat pay when I was in the Army. Whatever the technical term is now.
You said backslash A.
Excellent.
It's actually just out of it says
it's
out
just
of the
out
state.
Of the United States.
And the only difference between backslash A and the committee substitute is the outside the United States and getting combat pay in the committee substitute. This is just outside the United States, and I'm not bothered by that. I think that it gets beyond my comfort level if we do it for anybody in active military status, whether they're at Fort Bliss or Fort Lewis or someplace else. So I'm comfortable with the way the sponsor of the bill has it now.
Sharon.
Just two comments. One to Senator Huggins, Mr. Chairman, regarding the folks who are deployed from elsewhere, and certainly they are concerned too. Just to be sure that you all understand that any of those people, a parent or a friend, can file on their behalf and an unsigned application, and we pend that application until that person is in a position to send a signature in. So no one should be precluded in that situation. Yes, this would facilitate those folks as well. Getting the signature in quicker, but just that provision is there. And then if the other difference between the two bills is the requirement of a statement of intent to return that was included in the CS.
I don't particularly care for that part. If somebody oversees then sending in that statement of intent to return that.
You know, excuse me, Mr. Chair, I have full confidence in you and your guys and what you do, and that you have no intent of purposefully trying to deny it to somebody. My point is people that are deployed, that they shouldn't have to worry about it, all right? So it shouldn't be, my goodness, I got this one of the, that it just, it all should, if potentially transparent for us, not up to fraud, but just doing the right thing for them, because I would venture to say, by and large, the majority of people we're talking about are that deploy from the state that are graduates of some high school here are going to be gone for 3 or 4 years, and they'll be back here in the state. But it's a bunch of people, and it's an increasing number. And in the time we're struggling to recruit people, I mean, everything we can do to facilitate people wanting to be part of that process, I think the better we do for our country. I mean, I've even gone one step further, right? Because some people came to me about we need to do this and do that because we're skeptical of what they're going to do. And I said, my goodness, we should be paying them a bonus for going to do that. I mean, why not? If they go into Iraq, might lose their life.
Further questions? Is there anyone else here in Juneau that wishes to testify? Let's see. Questions? Will the committee. Senator Wagner.
Move House Bill number 201 /A with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Without objection, the bill will move to its next committee of referral.
Sure.
The last bill, House Bill 229.
Chairman, members of the committee, Paula Bull from Representative Foster's office. What you have before you is basically a housekeeping bill that allows Native corporations that have been involuntarily dissolved under AS 106633 to reincorporate, holding all the same assets, powers, and liabilities as the original ANCSA corporations. And it's a one-time window that would be sunsetting in 2006.
Is this, we've done this before, or are we just extending? So why the one-time extension that was going to sunset?
Mr. Chairman, yeah.
Senator Wagner.
Why don't we make that out to about December 31st, 2010? Maybe it won't come before us again. Maybe there's a technical reason we can't. I don't know.
Senator Wagner, through the chair, actually, that has been considered, but there is a constitutional issue of not binding another legislature.
So what's led us up to this point now? They've been involuntarily dissolved.
The corporations have failed, or Chairman, the corporations have failed to complete their paperwork and file with the state, and there is a grace period, and they have not filed and paid their late fees within that grace period, and they are involuntarily dissolved.
Okay, and what harm befalls us or them? Or
well, the ANCSA land grants given to the Native corporations under the ANCSA settlement by the federal government would no longer be the assets of any corporations were they to reincorporate as a new corporation. They would not have any of those assets, and one of the things is nobody is quite sure what would happen to all those assets. Would they be split up amongst the shareholders? Would they revert back to the federal government? Would they go to a regional corporation? We don't know.
And is that because of the federal law was very, very specific that it was to those corporations formed on that day type thing?
That is correct.
Well, a number of us have been here before, so. Senator Wagner?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move House Bill number 229 /A with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Without objection, bill will move from committee.
Thank you for your time.
See that next year.
No, year after.
Year after next, 2007.
Heather, are we anticipating any meeting before?
Before what?
Yeah, I didn't say before what.
Before our next regular Tuesday meeting. We don't think we're going to have to have a meeting.
You want to meet tonight?
But we are in 24-hour notice, so we'll let you know if anything comes up.
I'm really disappointed.
He's got two of my bills.
Oh, Betty, good to see you. I didn't get to talk to you much. Good to see you. I didn't get to talk to you much. But.
No, but it's all right.
Your wife gives somebody a power of attorney when you leave town to take care of the cat.
You say you wouldn't give it to anybody?
It's probably a very...
Are you adjourning?
Oh, yes, we are adjourned.
Oh, I'm sorry.